I appreciate very much the work that's been done to bring this together. In some ways, I appreciate that work more than you can know, because I worked very hard not to be here and wrote a very eloquent letter to Professor Fluker this summer about the several thousand reasons why I couldn't be here. And Walter just got himself and Sue Bailey Thurman together, and they put me in a vise, and here I am. I am here, though, not simply coerced, but happily coerced, and glad to be able to join with you for this morning's experience, which for me will not be so much a university lecture as a time of reflection on the theme of the conference, America in Search of a Soul. Last night, in the course of his grand and wonderful message to us, Dr. Massey spoke about the many memories which were clamoring for attention in his heart and mind as he stood in the pulpit of First Baptist Church. I know something about those memories, too. Indeed, they started clamoring for me at the airport when my young brother picked me up and asked me if this was my first time in Nashville. And I just had to smile a big smile and say, "My brother, my first time in Nashville was before you were born." And then the memories started flooding. And I simply want to share one of them with you, because it was indeed of my first time in Nashville. I was at that point living in Chicago and a member of a small multiracial congregation there. And for reasons that I can't go into fully now, a group of us from the congregation, two whites and two blacks, all men, decided that we were going to get into an old South Dakota station wagon and drive through the South. The four of us, black and white, brothers in the faith. And because we were brothers, we pledged, and this was 1958, we pledged that we would not allow ourselves to be separated under any circumstances, because if we believed what we said we believed, then there was no way that we could accept our separation. And we had quite a good time, I assure you, down first to Little Rock, across Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, at Georgia, and then up from Atlanta here into Nashville on our way back to Chicago. And while we were here, we had heard about Kelly Miller Smith and First Baptist Church. And so I got on the telephone to call First Baptist Church to ask if they could direct us as to how to get there. And the woman that I spoke to on the phone listened as I described who we were and why we were traveling and who we were looking for, and she said, "You got the wrong First Baptist Church." So we found the right First Baptist Church, and I'm very glad that that First Baptist Church was right with what God was doing in history. And so it's been a long time, 31 years, since that October of 1958, my first time here in Nashville. And of course, at that time, I had no reason to imagine delivering a university lecture at the Vanderbilt School of Theology. But we will say more about that as we go. The conference and its theme are very, very good for me, because I appreciate being sent back to Jesus and the Disinherited 40 years. I guess I first discovered it about 1956 or 7 or so. I appreciate being sent back to Howard's lecture at the Redlands, The Search, The America in Search of a Soul. I appreciate being reminded about the way in which he saw America's soul as made up of the search for community, the search for compassion, and the search for justice. And I especially appreciate being sent back to what may be perhaps my own favorite piece of Howard Thurman, The Search for Common Ground. And I'll say some more about that too as I go. But this morning, in expressing appreciation for being sent back to them, I recognize, and I trust that we recognize, that indeed we go back to them. We go back to 1949. We go back to 1971. We go back to 1976 for those three works. And we go back and discover that they have continuing value for us as persons, as a community, certainly as a religious community. We go back, recognize the powerful value, but we dare not stop there. We cannot stop, because Howard Thurman himself manifested for us the lesson of not stopping back there. I remember sometime in the 70s or early 80s, I don't remember exactly when it was, that Rosemary and I were visiting at 2020 Stockton Street, and one morning over coffee or something, Howard was talking about a whole set of things, and then he said to me something like, "You know, I don't know why people say they want to be like Jesus." And I guess he was feeling his heretical self at this point. And he said, "I certainly don't know why I would want to be like Jesus." He said, "Why should I, a black man in the United States in the 20th century, want to be like this Mediterranean Jew of the first century?" But he didn't stop there. He said, "What I want to do is go back and meet that Mediterranean Jew of the first century. And what I especially want to do is find out where he went for his power to be who he was being. And then I want to find that source of power for myself. And I want to go to that source of power, and I want to imbibe in that source of power, and then I will be the 20th century black man that I am meant to be under God's grace." We go back, but we go back not to simply reminisce or to embalm. We go back to seek for power in order to understand how we may go forward. And that is why I trust we are going back to 49 and 71 and 76 in order to understand how we go forward into the 1990s, how we move boldly with great anticipation and trepidation towards the 21st century. And so I'd like to participate in that going back right now for a while to reflect on Jesus and the Disinherited, to reflect on Howard Thurman's continuing call through that work and many other works, the continuing call to us away from fear and deception and hatred, to reflect on the continuing call to the love that undermines all fear and deception and hatred, to continue remembering that when Howard talked about love, it was never vague. It always had powerful solidity and concreteness to it. And so he could say towards the end of Jesus and the Disinherited, the religion of Jesus says to the disinherited, love your enemy. Take the initiative in seeking ways by which you can have the experience of a common sharing of mutual worth and value. Take the initiative. Sit in at Vanderbilt Divinity School. If they don't recognize that you are their sister and their brother, then go to them and make it clear, make it plain. That's what Thurman was saying in his marvelously disguised way. And he ended the paragraph, it may be hazardous, but you must do it. There cannot be too great insistence, he said, on the point that we are here dealing, that we are dealing with a discipline, a method, a technique, as over against some form of wishful thinking or simple desiring called love. Thurman was talking about the organizing of our very being to act in love in even the most dangerous situations. I think that what he tells us there and what he continued to tell us was that he knew at least two very large things that we certainly need to know. And one of them was that the search for America's soul had to take us all into the issue of race, racial justice, and racial reconciliation. No search for America's soul without facing the issue of race. The second thing he knew was that the disinherited, the rejected stones, must take the initiative in that search for the soul. Must take the initiative with active, costly, organized love. Thurman knew that and said that in his variety of ways, acted on it in his own particular individual way. But one of the most fascinating things about his message through Jesus and the disinherited was that the message has lived. The message took on a life that became a powerful life. And I want us to recognize this as we go back to 49, because as I said, we go back not to embalm, but to recognize the power that this took on. Lerone Bennett tells us, and Howard Thurman reminds us, that when he started moving towards his fullness of power, Martin King, when he started coming to the attention of the world, Martin King traveled around the country and the world with Jesus and the disinherited in his bag. But of course, not just Jesus and the disinherited in his bag, but Jesus and the disinherited in his heart, in his life. And Martin King, in a very profound sense of the word, became the Word made flesh among us. Jesus and the disinherited lived among us through Martin Luther King Jr. But what I want to say in Nashville is that we can see this even closer at home. For Martin King was not the only one in those days who knew Jesus and the disinherited at heart levels. Right here in this town, Jim Lawson knew Jesus and the disinherited. Right in this town, Kelly Miller Smith knew Jesus and the disinherited. Right here in this town, Diane Nash knew Jesus and the disinherited. How could she know? She was a Roman Catholic from Chicago. It's amazing what you can know when you determine to know. Those who hunger and thirst after rightness are guaranteed that they will know all kinds of stuff, especially if they are willing to live it out. So Diane, in all her Roman Catholic Chicago-ness, also knew Jesus and the disinherited, and that madman of the movement, C.T. Vivian, yes, he knew Jesus and the disinherited. And what I'm saying is that in those sessions, when Jim Lawson left his lonely crusade here at Vanderbilt and went into the meetings over at Kelly Miller Smith's Wright First Baptist Church and gathered together the students and others in those study sessions, in those workshops, in 1959, what were they working for? What were they preparing for? They were studying Gandhi, they were studying Jesus, and they were studying Stride Toward Freedom, and they were studying Jesus and the disinherited. 1959, what were they studying for? It's so marvelous. Sometimes we don't know what we're studying for. Sometimes we don't know what we're getting ready for. But Jim and his gang were getting ready. So they thought that they were going to start off something by confronting the downtown segregation here. And of course, all kinds of people, religious, irreligious, arreligious, totally non-religious, told them that that could not be done, should not be done, would not be done, and they'd end in jail if they tried to do it. Indeed, some people told Jim that he would end up being put out of the divinity school if he tried to do it. But Jim had some different understandings about what divinity is and how one gets schooled for divinity. And so he was reading Jesus and the disinherited and teaching Jesus and the disinherited. So when the folks at North Carolina A&T, where nobody had ever heard of anything ever happening, when they decided to happen and opened up the student movement of the 1960s, the folks in Nashville discovered what they were getting ready for. They were getting ready to, in a sense, take over that movement and give leadership to the whole student movement of that early 1960s period. Nashville, the Nashville group, in its early years, became the heart of the movement. When folks gathered together to form the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in April of 1960, the Nashville group, Bevel, Diane, James, others, they were right at the heart of it, supplying its basic ideology, coming out of Jesus and the disinherited, coming out of Stride Toward Freedom, coming out of Gandhi, coming into Jesus of Nazareth. And even now, it is fascinating to see, and I hope that this is becoming a part of the education at the Vanderbilt Divinity School. Even now, many of these Nashville folks from the 50s and 60s are still the long-distance runners of the movement for freedom and justice in this country. C.T. Vivian, still on the case. Diane Nash, still on the case. James Lawson, still on the case. Kelly Miller Smith, still on the case. Jim Bevel in his crazy way, still on the case. I hope that this is part of the education at Vanderbilt School. I hope that this is part of what we learn. Because what I am saying is that these women and men who immerse themselves in the study and the living of Jesus and the disinherited became central gifts to the movement for the transformation of the United States of America. That is how this work still lives. But that was the 1960s. We go back to honor and remember, but not to rest. This is almost the 1990s. What is the significance of Jesus and the disinherited for the current experience of this nation's ongoing search for a soul? Nations like people never quite get a soul. It's not something you get. It's something that you're always in movement into and toward and with. What I'd like to share this morning are several possible meanings that Jesus and the disinherited have for us now in our current search for a soul. And I want to say that these are simply suggestions, not doctrine, suggestions that may make our conversation with each other richer and more possible. One thing, clearly, the search for a soul is still going on, whether we know it or not. And racism, the need for racial reconciliation are still central issues everywhere. Nashville, Baltimore, Denver, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, wherever this nation searches for its soul, on the Rio Grande, in the gathering places of the Southeast Asians, where the new Caribbean folks have come together, race is still central to the search for this nation's soul. But now, as we come to the 1990s, for better and for worse, there is more. Now, as a result of the freedom movement that was so nurtured in this very city, now as a result of the demographic movements, or we might say in terms of what God is doing in this world, now other issues have been opened up for us. And so it is no longer, if it ever was, simply black and white. That is old-fashioned thinking. That could be indeed backwards tending thinking. It is no longer simply black and white. We are in search of a multicultural, truly plural society. And that search must become part of the larger vision. Any vision for the future of America's community that does not include Asians, that does not include people from all over India, that does not include natives of this land, that does not include Hispanics in all of their varieties, that does not include many other kinds of national and racial groupings, misses the point. That's what Spike Lee was trying to say for just a minute in Do the Right Thing. Me block too, was the call that went out from the Asian grocery man. Deeply significant call. By the way, see that and have a wonderful seminar about it, about where is Jesus and the disinherited in Do the Right Thing. Wonderful for the next seminar. Thurman, of course, always knew that this country was more than black and white. He knew it because of what was down in his own genes. He knew it in what was Sue's genes. He knew it wherever he traveled. And whenever you see those books of his, again and again, he comes back, among other things, to the natives of this land. They had a kind of a special claim on his insides. Thurman knew that. That when you speak about Jesus and the disinherited, it's more than black and white, but he focused on the black and whiteness at that moment. Now, in this moment, as a result of our movement and other movements at home and abroad, movements which we helped to inspire and bring into being, as a result of the deepening insights of Thurman and King and Diane and Ella Baker, what we realize is that the search for a soul involves race, involves color, but it involves much, much more as well. To search for the soul, we must take on American militarism, out of which so much of the violence of our society generally comes. To search for a soul, like King and Thurman, we must take on American materialism. To search for a soul today, we must take on poverty and classism and our relative ease in allowing poverty to exist in our midst. To take on the search for a soul today, we simply must deal with sexism and cannot get around it or away from it. We in this program must look at ourselves and say, how come we had 17 men doing stuff and 5 women? What does that mean? We go starting from ourselves and look at the issues. And even though dear Uncle Howard is with his generic man all through his 732 books, what I know is that Howard could not live with Sue and with those 2 daughters of his and be anything called a sexist, because they just wouldn't have it. They wouldn't have him. They put him out. But he did have to work with that language, as we have to work with the language. And of course, what we know is that it is more than language that we are working with. To search for the soul today means that we have to take on the issue of our irresponsibility to other life forms. He just lived with his penguins and his dogs and cats and all that kind of stuff, and believed that they were also repositories of the Spirit of God, and therefore affected how he had to think about them and relate to them and what messages they had for him. We have to take on our irresponsibility, because the irresponsibility to the biosphere is really irresponsibility to our children's children. And no people can ever find their soul, just as no person can find her soul, without a sense of responsibility to our children's children and their great-grandchildren. To search for America's soul today, we have to take on all the addictions that have seemed to be ready to destroy us. Not just the so-called drug addiction that we read about and see about in the paper, but all the other kinds of addictions, including our liquor addictions and our smoking addictions and our dependency addictions and our power addictions and our fear addictions and our violence addiction. To search for the soul in the 1990s, we've got to go to the fact that whole lots of people don't believe that there is any soul. No soul for themselves, no soul for their nation, and therefore they live absolutely prisoners to the present moment. To search for the soul, one has to deal with all of that. Now, on a certain level, that would be relatively easy to at least think about if we didn't go any further, but Howard Thurman never guaranteed us ease. He was constantly pressing us. And I want to focus now on some other particular ways in which we might read Jesus and the Disinherited for the 1990s. In the 30s and 40s, when Thurman was shaping this work, we Black Americans had a kind of, even though we didn't always say it in this way, we had a kind of sense of purity about us in relationship to the privileged and the underprivileged, the inherited and the disinherited. We had a kind of, even though we didn't always put it quite this way, moral superiority about us, because we were the beat up of the society, and we know that God always stood by the beat up. As you know, we were the originators of liberation theology in this country, at least as far back as David Walker, and further back than that. We always read Jesus and the Disinherited from that kind of position. We were the disinherited, we were the underprivileged, the others, those other folks. Sometimes we didn't name names, we just called you the other ones, the dominant society, blah, blah, blah. It was so interesting the way we did not speak your name. A problem in itself. For as Thurman tells us, names must always be spoken in order to keep our humanity intact. But we knew that white folks were the inheritors. White folks were the privileged ones. And that's how it was basically read by King and by Kelly Miller Smith and by Diane and John Lewis in the 1950s and 60s. But now the question is, how shall we read it? How shall we read it today in the 1990s? I think that we are in for some deeply unsettling thoughts if we start thinking about who we really are, where we really are, and who really ain't here. Some challenging thoughts, because what we have to deal with is that in the 1990s, indeed in 1989, Black Americans like us in this room, and Black Americans like a lot of other folks in other similar rooms, no longer have the luxury of standing unambiguously on the side of the disinherited Jesus of Nazareth. The fight's going to get tougher because we ain't as pure as we used to think we were. We no longer stand unambiguously at the side, identifying ourselves with that poor, homeless, colonized, quote, powerless, rejected Jew. We don't match up as evenly as we once thought we did. And so Jesus and the disinherited has to be looked at from some different perspectives if we're going to be honest about who we are, about where we are, and about who's not here. I think it forces a change of perspective, and our brother gave us the changes on perspective last night. It forces a change of perspective, it forces a change of perception, and perhaps it may even force a change of our sense of vocation for all of us, black, white, and everybody else. In other words, what I'm saying and what I'm asking is, what is the message now? Thurman always said, what is the message of the religion of Jesus? Notice the term that he used, the religion of Jesus. What is the message of the religion of Jesus for those who once were clearly among the disinherited and who now seem to have inched across the line? Who, me? Yes, me. What is the message of Jesus and the disinherited for those who now feel like we've inherited something? What we wanted all the time. Is that really what we wanted all the time? To inherit what they got? Was that all we wanted all the time? Back at the beginning of this century, there was a wonderful conversation between one of the early Russian revolutionists and an American who came to visit. And the American surprised the revolutionist Kropotkin by telling him that there were black conservatives in this country. And Kropotkin said, what? Black conservatives? And what do they have to conserve? What is the message of the religion of Jesus? What is the message of Jesus and the disinherited for those of us who now believe that we do have some things, and I do mean things, to conserve? As the outsiders, as the disinherited, we were once the major leaders of the search for the nation's soul. It was us, partly because we were outside and could see from a different perspective what was going on. What happens to the soul search of America if those of us who were once outsiders and have now inched our way in, if we become unreflective, comfortable inheritors of the nation's mainstream? What happens to the soul search then? Who carries it on? Do we assume that once we get into the mainstream, the search is over right now? I would suggest that Thurman was working out a word for us. Even more important, I think he's encouraging us to work out a word for ourselves. What is the message of the religion of Jesus for those who were once outsiders, once the disinherited, and who now feel we own a piece of the Vanderbilt Plaza, or the Vanderbilt Divinity School, or the good life in America? I think that we still need to hear the message that Thurman brought concerning fear, concerning deception, concerning hatred, concerning active love. But I think that in the 1990s, one of the central messages for the children of the disinherited who are now being called into an unreflected swim in the mainstream, one of the central messages for us is, remember, remember, for those of us who lived through the 40s and 50s and 60s, the new edition of the book is really called Jesus and the Disinherited Who Now Feel Like Inheritors. And the book in the new edition would be saying to us, there is one more danger to overcome. Fear, yes. Deception, yes. Hatred, yes. But now think about amnesia. Amnesia would be crucial to the new edition. For amnesia makes the fear different, becomes fear of losing our small foothold on the rock. Amnesia makes deception different. The deception becomes more and more and more self-deception. Amnesia makes the hatred different. Becomes more and more hating ourselves because we're hating our mamas and our grandmamas and our great-granduncles. So the great power of love, it seems to me, in the 1990s, must often be focused on amnesia. And many of you know, of course, that in the world of so-called physical ailments and mental ailments, love is a powerful treatment for amnesia. Among both the former disinherited and those original inheritors who think that all is well now, now that a few of the best of the old disinherited are on our staff or our faculty or in our government, all is well because amnesia reigns there as well. Now, finally, what shall we remember? What shall we remember if we are to continue in the forefront of the struggle for the soul of America? And this, for me, is one of the major reasons why we must not give ourselves up to amnesia, because the struggle for the soul of America, if anything, is deepened now. And I want to know who's going to carry it on if all we've got around us is a bunch of amnesiacs. I think that there's some things that we should remember, and I'll just mention these without expanding too much so that we can come to our closing. I think we ought to be sure to remember those who gave themselves. Those who gave themselves to all the earlier struggles for the soul of America. Remember that we are not here simply because we look good, smell good, or feel good. That we are here because oceans of blood were shed. Especially Nashville. Begin talking about the history of Nashville. And we can talk about what we need to remember from the 19th century on. Not to remember in any kind of accusatory, condemnatory way, but to remember rather, as our brother ended last night, to remember with rejoicing for those who made the way clear for us with their very body. What kind of human beings are we if we forget who cleared the way for us? If we forget who cleared the way for our coming, we will forget that we have to clear the way for other people's coming. And by that very token, become less human than anyone in the 19th century ever was. So we start by remembering those who gave themselves before us to all the earlier struggle for the soul of America, especially, as Lincoln would put it in one of Thurman's favorite little speeches, the Gettysburg Address, remember the honored dead, the James Reeb honored dead, the Medgar Evers honored dead, the Martin King honored dead, the honored dead that we can just begin to lift up like a litany and maybe build some new stained glass windows in our churches with those honored dead. I think we need to remember also what the dead died for. Remember that at our best, as we carried on the struggle, we blacks who gave leadership, those whites who were constantly allies with us, we must always remember that we were never struggling simply to be, quote, accepted. We were never struggling simply for, quote, our rights. We were never even struggling simply for equality. Who wants to be equal with people who do not know their souls? What we were struggling for, as Martin said, with SCLC back as far as 1957, we have come to struggle to redeem the soul of America. That's what we were struggling for. Nothing else is adequate. We were struggling, to put it in what we would call political terms, we were struggling to expand democracy in this land so that it would reach to all of its people. We were struggling to help America and ourselves become our best possible selves. We were entering into Desjardins' vision of our coming into being in the deepest, fullest way. That's what we were struggling for. That's what freedom meant in our songs. You almost never heard any of our songs talking about, we want civil rights. No, no. We want freedom. Freedom now. That meant the freedom to become the best possible human beings that we could be. We ought to remember what we were struggling for, because when we get to the inching line, when they tell us to inch over or to come on into the swim, we ought to remember what it is that we started out about. And never assume that inching over the line or jumping into the mainstream was what the struggle has been about. If we forget what the struggle is about, we forget who we are. Because we have been the great leaders of the struggle for the soul of America. We need to remember also in this generation those who opened the doors, Thurmans who opened the doors, the Kings who opened the doors, the Kellys who opened the doors, the Dianes who opened the doors. And we need to remember lots of other people who we have to be told about first so that we can remember them and know the price that they paid. Not the romantic price of becoming martyrs, but the price, the hidden price that they paid in bleeding ulcers, in nervous breakdowns that no one would quite talk about, in lives unhinged. One of them, one of the great wounded healers from that time, calls our house almost every week, and we just have to be on that phone and talk with him about stuff that we don't know what he's talking about, but what we do know is who he has been. And we talk to him for that, dreaming that one day he may be something more than we believe is possible. We have to remember, because remembering in that kind of situation is healing. That's why we speak of remembering, recollecting. That is a healing process if properly done. And then, of course, people like us in a place like this have to remember what the ultimate source of freedom is, what Thurman never let us forget, and therefore why we were set free. And of course, it's all wrapped up in that wonderful, simple statement from the Hebrew Scriptures, "Let my people go." Not so that they can also have BMWs, not so that they can also have three houses, not so that they can also have major bank accounts in several places. That is not the way the sentence ends from the Lord. We were told that there is a purpose for our freedom, and there ain't none of the things aforementioned. Don't check any of those boxes. We were told, "Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness." If we don't know why we're free, we ain't free. We need to remember, and we need to ask, what does that mean in the United States of America, in the Western Hemisphere, on this planet, in the 1990s? We are freed to serve God in the wilderness. As you can tell, I spend a lot of my time asking questions, and I feel all right about that, because my friend Howard Thurman used to do it a lot too. And I read someplace that our wonderful genius, Einstein, said that most people think that when they die, they will go to see a God who is clothed with all the answers of life. He said, "I believe that I will see a God who is clothed with all the questions of life," which may be more exciting. Now, the last word about what we need to remember, for me at least, is the most difficult, but the most necessary. What we who have inched along, what we who have dipped our toes in, need to remember are all of those folks who are still, without any ambiguity, without any question, without any doubt, very clearly now, today, still the disinherited. In Nashville, in Birmingham, in DC, in Denver, what we need to remember is the disinherited, especially for some of us, indeed, for all of us, we need to remember the disinherited who look and sound and feel like many of us in this room, because they are cousins. And there are a lot of white cousins who are disinherited, hidden away in lots of places in this country. The trouble with it, our black cousins won't stay hidden away. And they get us all uncomfortable. But that's good, because if they didn't get us uncomfortable, we might think that all the disinherited folks were taken care of and they're right here with us. No. We need to realize and recognize that now, unless we remember these people in the right way, we need to recognize that now our fear that Howard Thurman was talking about, now our fear is often a fear of them. We have to deal with that. And what neighborhoods do we feel most fearful walking through, driving through, pushing our buttons down through? We have to deal with the fact that now, very often, our deception is deception of them, trying to make them think we care about them when we're running in the other direction as quickly as possible. Now, we have to realize, hard word though it may be, that sometimes our hatred is hatred of them, because they have not gotten into the mainstream, because they don't have what we have, because they don't look the way we look, because they don't dress the way we dress, because they don't smell the way we smell, because they don't do what we do. And we say, why can't they be good, upstanding, law-abiding, inching across the line inheritors like us? Or why don't they disappear someplace? Or why don't they go to jail? Or to the army? Howard Thurman does not give us comfort easily. And all I'm saying is that now what we have to remember is that it is impossible for the United States of America to carry out a soul search with any integrity unless these disinherited, unless these young people, unless these left out people, unless these old people, unless these women people, unless these toxin-threatened people, unless these unemployed, underemployed, never employed, these homeless, displaced people, what I am suggesting is that we need to remember that it is impossible for us to find any way toward our soul that does not pass right through the least of these. That's the 1990s. Life becomes a lot more complicated, partly because we have to read Howard Thurman as if he is talking to black folks and white folks in the same way. We are on every side of the fence. A fascinating time. But I can't stop without suggesting one or two things that we might do, and that's how I stop. Two simple suggestions. One of them, especially for a setting like this, right where we are. I would suggest, and fortunately and unfortunately, I haven't looked at your curriculum at Vanderbilt, but I want to suggest that here in a place like this, we find some new ways to fight amnesia. To fight our amnesia concerning both Vanderbilt and Nashville, as well as our country. I could say a great deal about how curriculum could be shaped, because we've been struggling right through this at ILF over the last 2 years, how curriculum might be shaped to raise us from amnesia to some new health. But what I want to talk about particularly now is that we might do some very special things to enlarge the curricula the way that we normally define it. And one of them is to do some things which would help us to remember that we were not always enlightened. And that's all right. Indeed, that seems to be central to the Christian life. You don't go around singing songs about how you always knew what you knew and how you always been all right. No. We tell the story of how we overcame. What about Vanderbilt and Nashville doing that? If we can remember how the light began to come to us, perhaps we'll have even more to rejoice in then. Perhaps there could be a major celebration sponsored by this institution with Fisk and other institutions celebrating the time of the sit-ins and the freedom rides. A time when this country was being released to begin to find its soul in ways that it had never been released before. Why not? Those were essentially religious occasions. Do you understand what it means for people to be set free to become themselves? That is a spiritual task. Why not celebrate those sit-ins and freedom rides and reinterpret them in the deep meaning of what God has been doing here in this country? Make them part of the new American canon. Read them to our children. Read them to our students. Show them eyes on the prize and say, this is the scripture for the morning. This is how God was at work among us here. This is why this is possible. And bring back Diane. And bring back CT. And bring back Jim Lawson. And bring back James Bevel. And bring back John Lewis. And then recognize all the people who never went anyplace and who've been here all the time carrying the light. And then have some great telling of the story, especially for young people. Notice how few young people, really young people, have been among us these 2 days. Have some things that will really draw them, attract them, help them to know that this is their story. and then help each other to know that what we're dealing with is not simply a political movement, but what we're dealing with is great salvific history. Indeed, great soul-saving history. Do it next year, do it every 5 years, do it whenever. That's one thing. The second thing, the last thing, is on the very personal level. Perhaps as institutions and as persons, we can consider what we have forgotten. We can spend some more time thinking about what we need to remember as we continue the great pilgrimage to which Thurman was always inviting us. And I don't see any purpose myself in talking about Thurman without reading Thurman. And I want to close with his invitation and his encouragement. As many of you know, The Search for Common Ground was written as Howard's own personal response, among other things, to the struggle for black identity in this country, to the powerful search for the capacity of black people to love themselves. And he was worried about what happens when you build that capacity on moving aside from other people. Howard and Martin were so similar in these ways. When black power and black consciousness began to really explode towards the surface, I was teaching at Spelman and therefore very much involved with the young people who were part of the leadership of this movement. And both of these men, in their different ways and different places, called Rosemarie and I to come sit down, talk with them. What are the students talking about, they said. And Thurman, in his late 60s, assumed that students had something to teach him. And of course, he also assumed that he had something to teach them. He never gave up that responsibility. And his book then was struggling with that issue. And when he spoke about the present solution that people have found, he was speaking about the solution of a kind of black solidarity which seemed to him to be moving into separateness. But now I want to show us how wonderfully modern how it is, because I think we can take that term, the present solution, and apply it to all the ways in which we have stopped still right here in 1989. All the ways in which we have said, I can't do anything more about this. All the ways in which we've said, oh, structural poverty. That means you can't have American capitalism without millions of people being structured in poor. That's the way it is. Sorry, may I have my check, please? And we go on. We have accepted the present solution. Racially, economically, we don't even know what to do with Mr. Gorbachev making all kinds of funny sounds. Our president, other people tell him, shut up, you talking new stuff. We're not ready for that yet. We have accepted the present solutions. Listen to Howard Thurman now, what happens. It is my considered judgment that the present solution is a stopgap, a halt in the line of march, 1989, toward full community, or at most a time of bivouac on a promontory overlooking the entire landscape of American society. It is time for assessing and reassessing resources in the light of the most ancient memory of the race, meaning, of course, the human race, concerning community, to hear again the clear voice of prophet and seer calling for harmony among all the children of men and women. At length, there will begin to be talk of plans for the new city that has never before existed on land or sea. At the center of the common life, there will be strange and vaguely familiar stirrings. Some there will be whose dreams will be haunted by forgotten events in which a moment of insight they saw a vision of a way of life transcending all barriers alien to community. Among the elder statesmen and women will be those through whose blood the liquid fires of Martin Luther King's dream swept all before it in one grand surge of beatific glory. They will remember and wonder at what they see about them. King's dream of a demilitarized, compassionate, multicultural society. We will remember this dream and we will wonder at what we see about us. It will be discovered how long and under what circumstance will remain among the mysteries that the barriers of community can never be arbitrarily established. The barriers of community based on race or the barriers of community based on class can never be arbitrarily established, however necessitous it may be to seek to do so for good and saving reasons. Here and there will be those who will walk out under the stars and think lonely thoughts about whence they came and the meaning that their presence in the heaven inspires. They will wonder and ponder heavy thoughts about humanity and our destiny under the stars. One day there will stand up in their midst one who will tell of a new sickness among the children. Amnesia? Who in their delirium cry out for their brothers and sisters whom they have never known and from whom they have been cut off behind the self-imposed barriers of their fathers and mothers. An alarm will spread throughout the community that it is being felt and slowly realized that community cannot feed for long on itself. It can only flourish where always the boundaries are giving way to the coming of others from beyond them, unknown and undiscovered sisters and brothers. Then the wisest among them will say, "What we have sought, we have found. Our own sense of identity. We have an established center out of which at last we can function and relate to other men and women. We have committed to heart and to nervous system a feeling of belonging, and our spirits are no longer isolated and afraid. We have lost our fear of our sisters and brothers, and we are no longer ashamed of ourselves, of who and what we are. Let us now go forth to save the land of our birth from the plague that first drove us into the will to quarantine and to separate ourselves behind self-imposed walls. For this is why we were born. Men and women, all men and women, belong to each other. And they who shut themselves away diminish themselves. And they who shut another away destroy themselves." And all the people said, "Amen." Amen. Now, you know you ain't supposed to say amen after a university lecture, but amen anyway.